Hi everyone, this is Harris Zambaloukos, and this is the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Evening, Ilya. How you doing?
Evening, Ben Rock. I'm doing just fine. How about you?
Can't complain.
Hey,
gonna be as soon as we get done with this, I'm gonna be editing all night.
All right. Pulling an all-nighter. Gonna go into the wee hours in the morning, chopping, slicing, dicing.
Yep. Doing the old Premiere thing, using the text-based editor in Premiere, which, if you've never used it, wow, does that save you a lot of time.
Wow. All right. Hey, you know the old expression, if you can't solve it, dissolve it.
Thanks. No, I'll do that. I'll do lots of dissolving.
Nice. Hey, Ben, who is on the show today?
It's Harris Zambaloukos with an interview you did. I'm very jealous.
Yeah, it's great. We chatted about Beetlejuice, which is great. I don't know if you got to see it yet.
I saw it. I took my six-year-old son to see it. And my wife kept looking at me like, you did not take a six-year-old to see this.
And you were like, I sure did.
I'm like, the boy's got to learn about German expressionism sometime.
What better, you know, entree into the world of German expressionism than Beetlejuice. So
really liked it. Really gorgeous. I thought Beetlejuice, I mean, this isn't a comment on the cinematography in any way, except for to say that it's awesome.
It is.
But
yeah.
Like, I feel like there's no way to make Beetlejuice a fresh idea because because it's 35 years old. But I feel like they did a great job of finding fresh corners in it that we hadn't seen before and kind of revealing new stuff to us. I enjoyed it top to bottom. I really thought it was fun.
Ditto. It's great. Yeah.
And now, Close Focus.
And we're going to get into that, and I get into that interview with Harris in just a few minutes. But first, what are we chatting about this week? What is our Close Focus?
Well, something is going on right now, and it may not happen. So I you and I were both kind of debating. I don't know what we'll give the over under, but apparently DirecTV, do you remember them? Remember cable?
I used to pay them like $80 a month way back when.
Yeah, you and me both. So DirecTV is trying to acquire their immediate competitor from back then, Dish Network. Both of them were the ones that would like come to your house and stick a satellite dish on your roof. And at the same time, also Sling TV, if you have cut the cord, there's probably a 1 in 3 chance that you use Sling TV if you want to get your local channels and your food network and like basically sort of the basic cable package. There's a few YouTube TV, Hulu, you can do it on Hulu, but Sling TV seemed to have gotten in that market kind of before everyone else. So if DirecTV is able to get Dish Network and Sling TV, that would make them the largest TV provider in the world. Isn't that
weird? Wow, that is interesting and a little bit weird. And linear television, they do have like a on-demand service. I've used the DirecTV on-demand service like way in the past. They did have a that at one point, but I haven't used it in years, and I really don't know what DirecTV or Dish Network or Sling or what any of them are doing. It's been so long since I had any of that.
Sling, I mean, like Sling is still in the game very, very much, and according to an article that I saw in the Hollywood Reporter, not talking about as many subscribers as I might have thought. It's about 20 million, which is a lot, but
yeah, that's about how many they had when AT&T bought a controlling interest of them decades ago. And it's interesting because they tried to buy Dish Network before, and the government blocked them. That was in 2002. Yeah. So, and they said that, you know, it was going to be unfair competition or unfair lack of competition, unfair monopoly, especially for rural Americans.
I mean, to me, that is the very definition of antitrust. It's the only two companies doing the same thing merging into one. So there is no more competition in the market at all.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I don't know what's going to happen with that, and it doesn't feel like, you know, much ado about nothing, because it's a lot of people, and there's a lot of people like paying for that subscription. But it does satellite, getting your TV via satellite feels slightly antiquated, even though that's how a lot of people actually don't know it, but they're getting their cable. The cable's running to their house, but their, you know, cable service providers get taking in those signals from satellites.
Yeah, but also, how many people are getting cable service anymore? I mean, like, cable is kind of a dying thing.
It's still quite a few. It's still a lot. It is now, the tipping point happened about a year or two ago. I think the pandemic really spread it along, but there is now more streamers, cord cutters, than there are cable subscribers, but it is still like the second largest block out there.
I only recently, within the last few months, cut the cord. And part of it was when I looked at my bill to see how much I was spending on cable versus internet, I was shocked. I mean, like, I thought it was going to be like half and half. No, it was like 3/4 and 1/4, 3/4 of it was being spent on cable. And I'm like, I hardly ever watch it anymore. Like, who watches cable TV?
Yeah, internet speeds have continued to increase and costs has continued to come down. We're still really high compared to the rest of the world, but I feel like cable television, I feel like the bottom hasn't fallen out of that yet. I think that cable television prices are going to come down, and it's going to be almost like an add-on giveaway thing to your internet service here soon.
I mean, it would have to be. I mean, like, I honestly, if it was just a fair price, I'd be okay with it. But it was,
agreed.
It was a lot. But like, if this goes through, by the way, this officially takes AT&T out of television. This is like the last of their TV holdings. Mm-hmm. Oh, gotcha. And it made you laugh. So I want you to talk to you. How much would DirecTV be purchasing Dish Network for? What's the asking price?
The asking price is $1. This is true. This is a fact. They want $1 for Dish TV and or Dish Network, I should say. They want $1. And what I thought was quite funny is there was a comment on CNN where someone said, $1, they're worth at least $3.
Well, it's $1 plus assuming their debt, which is plus probably like debt,
$1.6 billion almost. Yeah.
Yeah. So that dollar doesn't really take much of a chunk out of that. That's throwing a brick into the Grand Canyon there, you know.
So the reason that AT&T is out is actually a fund is coming in to buy them out if this goes through. So like some giant fund is going to put $10 billion into it, supposedly. And who knows what $10 billion is? Nothing to sneeze at. That's an awful lot of money. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
I just wonder, like, if this happens, what's the cheapening? What's the downside for A, the consumer, and B, the industry that has to make the stuff that's going to be broadcast into these wonderful satellites that some percentage of people still use, apparently.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the private equity firm that is currently has a 30% interest in DirecTV is called TPG, and they're already in for about $1.8 billion. They're going to buy out AT&T's 70% stake. That's essentially what they're looking to have happen. So I think they have to get some they're front out of Europe, and I have no idea what their plans are. But usually private equity, they've got various plans typically to maximize their return on investment. And they probably have a fairly short time horizon because the people who put the money into that, they want to see return on investment. So it's a pretty big, you know, it's a pretty big gamble for someone if they don't already have a clear plan. My guess is they probably have a clear plan. No one makes this sort of gamble without clear plans in place.
Of course. Well, that's about as much as either one of us knows about this. So I think it's a story that is worth following. Why don't we go ahead and get to the interview?
Let's do it. Here's Harris Zambra-Lucas.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Harris Zambra-Lucas, welcome back to the Cinematography Podcast. It's so great to see you again. Last time was Belfast, and you've got a new movie now called Beetlejuice. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's nice to be here. It's good to see you again and nice to chat about it.
Yeah, I you know, this movie is a delight. It really is so much fun, and it looks like you guys had a lot of fun making it. Is this one of the exceptions where it was as much fun to work on as it is to watch?
I don't know. Maybe it was a bit more fun to make. We really did enjoy ourselves, and there was a huge kind of collaborative effort made here. And it was a real delight and a pleasure to kind of bring this to screen.
So Beetlejuice, 1988, Beetlejuice, 2024, 26 years in between here. Can you talk a little bit about how much you had to take into account the original look versus the new look? Where does the look come from?
Well, I was hugely inspired by Beetlejuice. I was 18 years old when it came out, and it made a huge impact on me. I'm a huge fan of Thomas Ackerman, the original cinematographer, and I thought his work was absolutely incredible. So I certainly wanted to play tribute to that and be respectful to the film and see where we could take this.
You're rekindling this movie, which probably was never conceptualized from the beginning to have a sequel, all these years later, original shot on film, shot on Panavision. You're coming back to it now, I'm assuming digital. I'm assuming Venice 2, something like that. I'd heard a little bit from Panavision. Panavision, Auto Panatar lenses 2, that sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the modern update of the original sort of style that you came up with?
Well, I'm fortunate enough to still shoot a lot on film and still do, but there was a personal choice from me that I suggested to Tim about shooting this digitally. One of the things that I think attracted me to shooting this digitally is the Sony Venice 2's kind of 3200 ASA sensitivity. I'd used it on Haunting in Venice. That it was a new camera. I'd only used it on one film, and I went into prep for Beetlejuice immediately after Haunting in Venice. And I'd used the auto and the ultra Panatars on Haunting in Venice, and they just managed to give you a very high fidelity image at a very, very low light sensitivity, and create a 1.85 aspect ratio at over 8K. By that point, because the auto and ultra Panatars are so rare and so few sets, you can literally only do one film at a time with them. They had developed the Ultra Panatars 2s, and they're a far more ergonomic modern housing, but they have all the characteristics of the original Panatar lenses, and they have a certain magic to them. But I think primarily for Tim, I wanted to create an image that was a native 1.85 aspect ratio that didn't require cropping and that was very flattering in the portraiture. And I felt that the Panatars could do this. I felt that their fall off at a reasonable f-stop at 4 to 4.25 was great. But that still gave me leeway if I wanted to put things out of focus more in the background. I had some leeway. All my decisions I made instinctively, and my questions to Tim were about instinct. So we would discuss things and plan things out, and there was meticulous planning from my side in terms of the lighting of the film in regards to making it a really easy environment to work with the performance. So the spaces were lit as spaces that could work in camera and could create a kind of atmospheric lighting that was inducive to portraiture without much effort on the day. And that took a lot of planning and a lot of experiment.
Really, guessing, yeah.
Of experimentation. But what that gave us on the day is the ability to improvise quickly and also set scenes in a way that allowed everyone to participate. And when I say everyone to participate, I mean that from an acting point of view, from a puppeteering point of view, from an atmospherics point of view, flow in a way that was uninterrupted and that would allow some improvisation. An example is really how much we all work together. SFX puppets, even our grip team, for, say, elevating actors. So everyone was involved. And I think that what happens there is you can truly interact off each other and off the scene and off the nuances of what's being done in a way that is impossible any other way.
Yeah.
A recounting that Tim told me, and it shows a little insight into his way of thinking. He traveled many decades ago to Japan because he was fascinated by Godzilla performance. And unbeknownst or unknown to me was that it's a very special performance. So what Tim explained to me was that there is one particular Japanese puppeteer that made quite a few Godzilla films. So he would dress up in the suit and he would interact with all the kind of in-house SFX. And that was a singular performance. That was attributed to one human being and his performance, and that ran over a few films. And in Tim's absolute mastery of that kind of medium, he wanted to meet this hero of his. Now, to me, that spoke volumes about kind of his attention to detail and his appreciation of performance. That in all these crazy worlds, this imaginative world, the idea that the human aspect of it was singularly more important to him than anything else.
Yeah. Well, you know, I definitely get the feeling watching Beetlejuice of some elements that kind of remind me a little bit of, like, you know, Man in a Costume, like particularly the Bob sequence, the sequence where Beetlejuice is inside of his workshop with all these, you know, shrunken head, you know, minions. And I have to imagine there's a human in every single one of those, and that they're completely like, yeah, I don't know if they're looking through a tiny piece of fabric or if it's all pantomime or how they do it, but it seems like that must have been a kind of incredible sequence to shoot, where all these people have, you know, they're running around and they're doing things, and they are sort of massive in the world. They're like, either they're you know, comically out of proportion with everything else, and then they have these tiny heads. Can you talk a little bit about that sequence, and did that the reference to the Japanese Godzilla performer come into effect in something like that, or is that just me reading into it?
Well, that was a personal conversation we had with Tim, but it explains a lot. So Neil Scanlon, our incredible kind of special effects makeup and puppet master on this, worked with particular performers. So Bob was one performer, as were all the shrinkers. So they wore a suit that they created in collaboration with Colleen Atwood. And what they did is the shirt was over the face. They could see, Colleen picked a fabric that you could just about see through. So the tie went over the nose and left enough space for the eyes to see. And then on top of that was an animatronic head that had servers for the eyes and the mouth. And so that was a massive coordination. That takes about three to four puppeteers, for example, for each shrinker. And there's a handful of them, if not more, in the boiler room. And on top of that, you've got Michael's incredible performance as Beetlejuice, which is full of energy. And at that pace and that energy level, it only, like, you only have so many takes. So, and then you add to that there's a camera move, and that there are probably 20 or 30 lighting cues just in a single 15-second take. And all that all has to work, and that is the collaboration. And that is the performance. So in essence, we're all performing there. And we also all do not want to let anyone down, because the person that makes a mistake is the one that ruins it for everyone. And so the stakes were high, and it was, but that only because you don't want to let your team member down. And I've never been on a film where we all worked in unison in that way. But that's probably because I've only made one Tim Burton film, and there's no one else that works quite like him. But yes, every performer, every shrinker had a specific performer, and you could never replace that performer with someone else. That was their character. They had their character. They had their particular photos on the desk. So to tremendous detail, you know, they all had cats. So there were photos of cats and dogs and their pets and et cetera. And they all played with Tim a huge kind of part in creating their own shrinker character.
It's so much fun. It's really a great scene. All right. So let's talk a little bit more about the lighting. There's saturated colors. You've mentioned already that you were lighting environments. You've had a pre-light going, so on the day it could just be a little bit finesse, and that people could exist in these spaces. Talk a little bit more about this process for you. Are you a fan of bounce lighting? Are you a fan of negative? I'm not saying, you know, reveal your recipe for everyone here who wants to make their own Beetlejuice in their backyard, but to tell us a little bit more of how you get into it, the nitty gritty.
Well, I had to find a way of kind of tributing the original kind of afterlife lighting. But add something to it. So I felt that it should undulate through different colors and intensities. So we have technology now with LED RGBW lighting that you can start experimenting that way. So I spoke to Tim about this idea and he was very enamored with it. And I said, well, I think we should stay within the realms. We shouldn't go into oranges and other colors, but we should stay within kind of our base is green. And then so at the other end of that spectrum, you go towards blue. And on the other end of that spectrum, you're going towards kind of magenta and purple. But we should never go. We just talked about it and we set these parameters and we said that any other color we'd introduce in another way. So I set about kind of doing some tests for Tim where we did this and we showed these changes in color. And then we talked about, well, what do you do outside the windows? Well, we certainly weren't going to do blue screen. And I have for almost 20 years now used a kind of a particular personal process, which includes using a back projection material stretched over vast areas and then using RGB color mixing behind it to create either a sky or a sky color or a particular look, and then it could turn into a blue screen if we needed it or not. But so we use this method in places like the boiler room, and then what Mark Scruton, our incredible production designer, did is then he started working with different types of glass and patterned glass and breaking up what was behind to make this feel kind of as if this is a glow on the other side. There was obviously smoke and some mist effects and some water dripping down all of this. So this combination created this kind of change of color that could then be mapped and manipulated through our dimmer board. We basically IP addressed every single light you see on a set down to the smallest diodes that are in the practicals, and we could assign a pattern or a color to each any illuminating object in a set. And we found that in our experimentation that going out of sync and everything doing something different was more interesting than putting everything in sync. But it took a while to kind of get a kind of, well, Tim called it a repertoire. So, and if he liked it, he would like the repertoire. But we had a few things that we had tested and shown him. We started gathering as we progressed in shooting what he actually liked, and would do little demos and say, you know, this is A, B, and C, and which one do you think for this scene? And he'd pick one, and we used kind of our own instinct. And it was quite quick because the work had been done in prep.
Gotcha. You definitely have very distinct looks going on in your different set pieces. There's a very distinct look in the miniature set sort of world when the family and Beetlejuice sort of are shrunk down or jump out. There's definitely the look of the afterlife sort of netherworld, and then there is sort of this outside of the house around town, sort of like a more normalized, almost Mayberry sort of quality. Can you talk a little bit about just the contrast of wanting to create the different looks in these different areas to, you know, I mean, they're stark, they're, you know, night and day differences. So I feel like each time we kind of travel to each of these places, we get a feeling, we get a vibe, we get an energy from each of them. The place and the lighting and the style sort of evoke a quality. Was this as intuitive as the rest of the process? Did you just kind of feel it out? Or talk a little bit about the contrasting, you know, set pieces.
It was intuitive, but at the same time, to my eye, and I think we shared a similar kind of palette and taste with Tim, is that going too heavy in one direction almost negated the effect that it was having. So I would always try and do something that kind of was almost like a palate cleanser. So if we were in that undulating wood, like for example, in Willem Dafoe's kind of office, there would always be a tungsten light somewhere. There would always be a source of something that was quite extreme blue green and quite dark. And we used kind of robotic projection lights going through the blinds in that particular scene. But there was always a kind of little tungsten source somewhere that just gave you a just standard kind of around about 3000 Kelvin glow. And to me, that was just always added to taste to kind of balance things out, that we never stayed in a fully kind of colored world. And even our stage work, that, for example, the interior of the house, both Jeremy's house or the Dietz house, were shot in sound stages in, at least in studios at Warner Brothers in London. Instead of going for blue screen out the windows, we used the same screens and the same lights that we use for the afterlife. But we just programmed a different kind of a more natural sky color in that. So you're already, there's an infusion of the different worlds, but just used, if you use the same ingredients, but you change the balance, you can create, I think, a world that the audience recognizes and flows through in a very effortless way, rather than imposing something completely new to, I think it's about creating a language. And that's what we did. We kind of gradually, we had a lot of prep to talk about it and think about it and plan it. And then we just gradually used the same terms.
Yeah, I gotcha. So speaking about the prep process, talk about specifically the animated lighting sort of work you were doing with your board op and your gaffer, I'm assuming then, because I assume that it wasn't so much finding it on the day, but it would be like cycling programs or, you know, saying, hey, we kind of like this combination of teal and green and cyan here or whatever it might be. And then, you know, oh, we like this combination of magenta and blue. Was that is also intuitive, or are you setting up charts or bringing in talent, or how do you choose?
No charts, but it's exactly as you just described it. So, and also this wasn't the first film we'd used this technique. So, for example, in How to Get our Sky Colors for a More Natural Effect, we used the same screens and the same lights for Death on the Nile, but they were around about a kilometer long. They surrounded the Karnak and 15 meters high. And what we did is we used real photography for skies in Egypt. And at one point, what we did to demo its effect is we said, let's take a still, different types of day in, and let's program a time lapse of a sky from sunrise to sunset to darkness and back through. And we programmed that in. And it took a day of programming, but that gave us, you know, you could then pick the times of day. We did something similar for the afterlife. So we almost did a kind of a time lapse of what it would be like. And we did it and we could then just note it. But this was, we'd already done, as I said earlier, I mean, for me, this type of a process, I started on Mamma Mia. So that was about 2008. So this technique, and it's just evolved over time. So I use very kind of, I try to keep as much crew as I can over over my films. So this is, I think it's been building up to using this technique for me as a safe tool, a comfortable tool, something that I'm familiar with. And it just found a right, at this level, the right home for it.
All right. I want to dive into this just a little bit more, because this is fascinating to me. And I haven't heard, at least I don't think, specifically this sort of technique that you're describing for this sky projection mapping, creating with light. Is it, you weren't actually going out and shooting a time lapse and then projecting that. You were creating through the animated effects light against your screen material to simulate the sky, and you were able to pick the colors and the transitions so that you could simulate different types of day and the intensity and the colors and that sort of thing. So essentially you've got like a translucent material, which becomes the sky. Then you've got different lighting instruments that are front lighting or back lighting.
It's all backlight. And in this case, only a sky effect. On Mamma Mia, it was a bit more technical, but again, and this all only works out of focus. So
of course,
in the background, you can't see the texture. With something, so it is, I call it a form of impressionism. And the tools have changed. They were very different tools on Mamma Mia and very different tools now. To kind of make this work to a far simpler way and a more impressionist, but easier to use and easier to set up with more variation, it took the creation of the sky panel for me to and so I think the it hasn't changed for me since Death on the Nile in terms of the tools that I'm using in the way. It's just the degree of control and its use has kind of gotten to this point. And I think it's quite theatrical, so it can only be impressionist to some extent in a realistic way, and then it just becomes a something that is keyable, but also a lighting effect without going to the in any way the expense of a volume, and predates volume by
decades.
Yes. So yeah. But in this case, I think, and with the kind of very clever kind of production design that was implemented, we were able to create the kind of afterlife background in camera.
I'm really impressed by all of the in camera. Like I know it's so difficult to tell these days because you know the effects get better and better, but I feel pretty strongly when I see a lot of Tim Burton stuff, I know I'm seeing a lot of puppets, a lot of in camera, a lot of really stuff that's happening in front of the camera. Maybe it's enhanced, but there's a lot that's happening there. Can you talk a little bit about the in camera work and having to get it right on the day because you don't have that safety net of just a big piece of like green or blue material and some artists that are going to work on it for 6 months?
Well, it goes back to that singular performance. In creating something in camera, there's one desk op, for example, one gaffer, one puppeteer, it becomes a singular performance. And that's why I feel it was such a kind of collective performance. We all played one small part to this. I mean, center stage, obviously, is kind of Tim's imagination and the performance that you get, which is just, it's unimaginable without Michael Keaton. But to do that and have no intrusion, because it's all in camera, and that he can play off what he sees out of the boiler room. He can play off the shrinkers. The shrinkers can play off him. We can react in our lighting cues to what the performance is doing on the day in camera. There's something that you just can't. The cumulative effect of that is I believe greater than the sum. And I think I can't describe that any better than saying that there is a performance aspect to that.
I would go so far as to say is that there's so much good sort of practical gore from like all the people, a lot of the people in the afterlife, they're in the state of the last moment they were in when they passed. So you've got people with these gaping wounds and all kinds of other things going on. Some of them are animated. And I know from, you know, having to work on movies that we're doing in camera effects decades ago, you got to be sometimes careful to not show too much of those things. You got to be able to sell it. Granted, on a Tim Burton movie, I'm sure there's no expense spared for creating these in-camera effects. But are you sometimes also like, we got to put this one a little bit more in shadow? We got to sell this a little bit better. How does that process work for you?
It's a combination of both that, but also I think Tim's use of humor in these situations that allows you to not stare at something, just the right amount of horror versus humor. I think if anyone thinks this is easy this comes so naturally to him and he's been doing it for so long that it glides through and you appreciate it, understand it, see what you need to do, you need to see, and don't see what you're not supposed to see, because there's been, it is thought, but it's quite effortless thought, and it could so easily go wrong. I mean, you definitely feel that.
Oh yeah,
that it could very easily go the wrong side of humor or the wrong side of horror.
Yeah,
I never felt that on this shoot. It just always felt just right.
It's a tightrope for sure, but the movie walks it so well. It's like, you know, I won't say that I ever felt the sort of like horror that I would feel from a straight horror film, but at the same time too, it's like, it's not a bright comedy. It's not all comedy. There is this circuitous route that kind of walks between, you know, gore and sort of like the afterlife, idealized sort of a modern day perfect world, and finding the funny in both of these situations as they kind of collide, as they overlap. It's brilliantly done. It's for me, that's the fun of the movie. The movie, Beetlejuice just has so much good stuff in it like that. So each of these scenes and these set pieces, a lot of them, they move really, really fast. I know on set, things hardly ever move fast. And that pace, it's like you probably are setting up and doing work for what's going to end up being 6 seconds, 9 seconds, maybe 20 seconds of screen time. Can you talk a little bit about the pace of working to collect these pieces? Especially I'm thinking of like, you know, sort of like action sort of chase sequences as you get to the bottom. I imagine that was weeks and weeks of work to get that in the can. How does the pace of the movie correlate to the pace of making your days?
This was actually a low budget, low schedule film for its ambition. It was a 9-week shoot, so there were no nine
Wow.
weeks. There weren't weeks and weeks and weeks of doing chase sequences. And unlike any film I've done, because it's so complex, each shot is so complex that I think there was not a single deleted scene. So everything we shot is actually in the film. There may be a few deleted shots or unused shots, but we really did. You're really watching everything we did. But what was really interesting and fantastic, again, and this is what I mean by Tim just adds a pinch of salt as he goes along and makes things better and better and better. I thought his editing with Jay was superb. And what they managed to do, even on the first, very, very first cut that I was lucky enough to see, after about 8 weeks of editing, they showed an assembly and I watched it. And what it had done, it had already rewritten, although the story was exactly the same, in a way the rewriting and the edit was into how much you used the afterlife and how much you saw the real life. And from the get-go, they had created an incredible balance there. I mean, that was right from what we would call the first edit. So I think, again, they used their instinct. As we progressed, it got better and better and better, but there was a real understanding of that, and you can feel it in that. You could strip this down to it's a story about a family who are meeting for a funeral. I think the complexities of the human condition of a family meeting for a funeral and losing a loved one are explored quite well. in the film. And then this madness happens on top of it. That is quite an orchestra piece to put together, and to put it together in such a fun way as well, where you, I feel like it's a very ambitious film with a very unconventional story, because of the demonic world, because of the imagination that you can see, that you're kind of talking about death in this almost humorous way at one moment, in this horror way in another moment, and flipping between the two, and then having really great intimate moments. Now that balance of how much you see for how long, how deep you go, how humorous you go, I don't know, it was just wonderful to kind of watch that very nuanced kind of directing. Tim, that's all Tim.
Yeah. Well, certainly it feels like a singular vision. It doesn't feel like a movie by committee. It feels like, you know, very, very much. And it plays out so spontaneous for being so meticulously planned. And I can't believe you did it in 8-9 weeks. That to me seems like it seems incredible. I would have guessed minimum, probably twice that. But the fact that you guys pulled it off is dazzling to me. Okay, so did you get to see it with an audience? Have you been to see it with a crowd? And tell me what that was like. Did it hit the way you thought it would?
The first time I saw it was with an audience was at the UK premiere, and then the following weekend I took my children and my family to see it at our local cinema. It's so personal for the filmmakers, and particularly I think for those involved in the post-production, which at the very end of the post-production I'm very involved. So you just grow so accustomed to it. I think for me to enjoy the film properly as an audience member and detach myself to some extent, I think I need to wait a little.
Okay, but were there moments, I should say, that when you did see it with your family in the local cinema, where you're like, ooh, you were excited this was coming up, and then delighted to see that the audience found the same sort of joy in those moments? It's like that I feel like is kind of what it all makes it worthwhile. You know, it's nice to get the paycheck, it's nice to get accolades, it's nice to get all things, but when you're actually there and you have the human interaction of other people who are experiencing like actual joy from the work and labor that you put in for giant chunks of your life. I mean, can you talk a little bit about that feeling?
There's a very palpable experience in, say, music, once you're up on stage and you're gigging, and that kind of that reaction and relationship with an audience. There's a palpable kind of interaction with an audience in a theater if you're designing the lighting and doing the cues. In terms of making a film, it's a little bit removed to some extent. So it's not exactly the same. But what you did definitely feel on this film, which I think is different from others, is because it was so much in camera and it was such a collaborative performance from everyone, you really knew when we had a good take. Like when it all gelled. I would say my moment in what you are describing, and I think the moment for many of us, came on set. Mm. In watching it in an audience, there's certainly a, you know, you can certainly hear the giggles, and you can certainly kind of feel the silence when you've touched on something that's kind of, whether it's awkward or a little profound or maybe a little close to home as well. That's very palpable in a theater. But I think overall what was really thrilling to kind of just try and gauge people leaving the theater was a little bit of the shock. I don't think people kind of expected this film. I think that is maybe one of the things that we were, I would say I'm particularly happy about and proud of, is the unexpected nature of it. I think it's an extremely
kind of experimental and odd film that's done with a lot of heart and a lot of kind of heart on sleeve and imagination on sleeve. And it seems to strike a chord. And that is a really gratifying kind of experience to have as a filmmaker and to be part of.
It really is a delight. I think that is a wonderful place, actually, for us to wrap it up. Harris, is there a place online that people can find you if they want to check you out? Do you do any of the socials, or do you have an official website or things like that?
I do have a website. I think it's zambaloukos.com. I don't have Facebook, but I do have an Instagram account at Zambagram. But it's I'm afraid there's not too much kind of work-related things there. It's just some fun that I share online.
Well, we'll put links to both of those on the show notes over at Cam Noir. Harris, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. It was great talking to you. Thank you.
So that was Harris Zambaloukos. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Harris. Awesome work, as always.
Indeed. Well, I look forward to having you back. Who knows? Maybe someday there'll be a Beetlejuice.
I mean, if you get the ticket for Beetlejuice, don't they have to have like an infinite number of Beetle guy who will come out and, I don't know, haunt you?
I don't know, but there's an awful lot of syllables there. So I'm hoping that they do keep making these movies. But by the time they get to the fourth one, I hope they call it like, to the fourth power or something. They gotta like. I don't want to have to be saying Beetlejuice that many times. I hope by the third one they have another.
I'm definitely dating myself here, but when I was a pimply teenager and I worked at a movie theater, I would often work box office, and people would come up and we're going through a period of wordy titles. My favorite one was Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, where people would be like, two for Honey, and I'm like, Honey what? I would like I would make them say the whole thing. And I was not there when Throw Mama from the Train came out, but it was always a joke about, like, not a joke, but it was always something that it was the stuff of legends of the different things that people called Throw Mama from the Train. And my boss Eric Bose's favorite one was Toss the Bitch.
God. I remember Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead.
Ooh, yeah, that's a long title. Yeah, we don't really have the long titles like that.
No, it seemed like it was
2024. We got to move fast.
In fact, it's even fewer syllables these days. So yeah. You just got movies called like Us.
And Nope.
Exactly.
And now, Short Ends.
Anyway, so Ilya, it is our patent pending time for our Short Ends, our pet obsessions of the week. I can see you're very excited to talk about something. I can see your excitement is palpable. I can palp it. What is your thing this week?
I really just wanted to like reverse the order because I'm always doing you first. So I feel like, you know, we should just mix it up sometimes. So
that's totally fair.
Now you can have the grand finale slot. So
All right.
So we haven't talked about this, but I'm kind of a fan of Stranger Things. I think Stranger Things is a pretty darn good series. To me, I feel like it's got to be one of the longest running, you know, maybe next to like Ozark, but like, you know, best series that Netflix has ever put into the world. I think it's great. And I was pretty pleased to hear that the final season is coming. And whenever they say this is the final of anything, this is the chance for them to pull out all the stops. This is the chance for them to really try to one up and do something that they haven't done before and do it in a way that has finality. There is not going to be any like leaving it out there to come back.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, all of the main characters are going to be done with puberty and will no longer be adorable.
So one of the first things they did to really raise the stakes, and this is what got me excited, is Frank Darabont. Frank Darabont is coming to direct season 5, and
the whole season.
To my knowledge, yeah, he's come out of retirement. Whoa. To do this. So
I didn't realize Frank Darabont was retired. He was retired.
He's kind of been out of the scene for a while, but yes, he made, of course, so many great things. Including,
I'm learning so much right now,
including The Shawshank Redemption.
Of course,
you know,
The Walking Dead.
Walking Dead, but if we jump back in time to, like, I think Shawshank Redemption was like 94, and you know, I was in film school in 94, and Frank Darabont, for whatever reason, decided to come to San Francisco State and do an early pre-release screening of the Shawshank Redemption.
Whoa.
For, like, the film department with, like, you know, maybe 800 of my closest friends or something like that, whoever, like, the film department was at that time. And when it was over, like, when the movie was over, he sat around and did a Q&A with, a bunch of us, probably 100 of us that were there. And he said, hey, you know, what, you know, I want to donate to the script library here at the school, the two scripts I'm most proud of, which at that point was Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and The Shawshank Redemption. And he handed them to me. And we had a nice little conversation. I said, yeah, I'll take him to the office.
I would have asked him for Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3 Dream Warriors, which he co-wrote.
Yeah, he wasn't, I guess, as proud of Dream Warriors as he was.
He should be. That movie's awesome.
I did see that movie as well. But regardless, I got to say that, like, before I took it to the office, I immediately went home and I read both scripts, which was fantastic, which is super cool. And I really enjoyed a lot of the stuff that Frank Darabont has done over the years and have been involved with. So the fact that he's coming back and doing Stranger Things, I'm enthusiastic about what sort of spin that he might put on this. So I think it bodes well. I think that Netflix, you know, produces a lot of stuff that I will tell you just kind of washes over you, really forgettable, doesn't, you know, it move the needle. I think that Stranger Things has been one of those series that has been sort of an exception. It has become part of the zeitgeist. It has, particularly for sort of like a youth culture today, become a touchstone for them. And the fact that they are really going to try to up the final season, I think, is great. So I'm excited for that. So Ben, what is your short end this week?
My short end is a horror movie that I had never heard of that is in theaters currently. And the only reason I even became aware of it is that I've probably talked about it on the show, but a couple of years ago, in order to force myself to go see more stuff in the theaters, probably about a year ago, actually, I got a subscription to Regal Theaters, which is like $23 a month, unlimited movies. You can go to as many as you want. So if you go to two movies a month, which... before I was a dad, that would be like every week I would go to two movies. But if you go to two movies a month, it pays for itself. And so it makes me a little bit less cautious when I see something and I don't really know what it is. So so I saw a movie starring Samara Weaving, and I'm a big fan of Samara Weaving's. I think she does really great work, called Azrael, that is directed by E.L. Katz. And I don't know if you're familiar with E.L. Katz.
No.
He's probably best known for a movie called Cheap Thrills. That's a really good film. And it was written by Simon Barrett, also second unit directed by Simon Barrett. And Simon Barrett is probably best known for writing most of Adam Wingard's movies, including things like You're Next and The Host and the 2016 Blair Witch. But he also had a hand in writing, I believe, Godzilla versus Kong and all that other stuff.
Hmm.
And Simon's a really good writer. And so Azrael is a movie that is almost without words. Like, it takes place after the post-rapture and everyone has decided not to speak. And it's mostly a survival horror movie with kind of... incredible but subtle supernatural overtones in the way that it's done. And I went to see it kind of on a lark with my friend Greg, just like game day decision. Mostly takes place in kind of a different post-apocalyptic world than you're used to seeing, but it's mostly in the woods. And there are these like horrible wraith-like creatures that you don't exactly understand what they are, that are sort of hunting everyone down, but they're scary as hell. And I just really liked it. I don't know. I mean, like, it's not going to change your life, but I think it's a really solid movie. I think E.L. Katz is a really underrated, really solid director who does great work. The script is good. Samara Weaving is good. The cinematography by somebody named Mart Tanyel. Do you know Mart?
I don't.
Yeah. It's really good. It's just a solid fun, scary movie. It's in theaters right now. I think it's going to be on Shudder pretty soon. Shudder had a title card at the beginning, so I assume it's going to be on Shudder. And they've been putting more stuff out in theaters. Like they put Late Night with the Devil out in theaters a few months ago. And I don't know. I mean, I don't feel like they're trying to replace Blumhouse or Neon or A24 or anything like that. But I do think Shudder kind of has its own vibe a little bit. And this was just a rock solid, fun, scary survival horror movie. Totally worth checking out if you're looking for something cool to do this week.
It sounds cool. Yeah.
All right.
Well, Ben, I think that just about does it for our show. Where can people find you if they want more Ben Rock?
They can find me at benrock.com. That's exactly the way it sounds. And you can find my bio and all that crap, and all the links to my social media. There's a lot of social media. A lot of people have found me on social media from here. So hello and thank you, and I appreciate every one of you. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
You can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com, Burbank, California, Portland, Oregon. This week in Portland, but I'm planning my return right now. So you'll be seeing me show up at your place and revamping your YouTube setup.
Oh boy, you have no idea. You know, like if you're watching you're watching this on YouTube, the area that you see right here is a very carefully curated area of my office where you can see none of the mess.
It is one square foot probably, and it's deeply out of focus. So yeah. All right, so Ben, who do we have to thank this week? Who made this show possible?
As always, we should thank our intrepid producer Alana Cody, who's got us. We're barreling into award season, so she's got us both pretty busy with the interviews, and she's working her ass off to make this show. It would not be anything without her. So thank you, Alana Cody. We got to thank our kick-ass editor Michael Dispenza, who does his best to make us not sound like imbeciles. And if I sound like an imbecile, I'm actually okay with it. And then last but not least, we got to thank Kays Alatrachi, who's directing another project right now.
Sounds like he
composed all the music that you heard on here on this episode. Check out his work at musicbykays.com and hire him to score your next movie or color grade it or do visual effects for it or direct it or do all of those things. Just hire him. He'll entertain you. He'll come over to your house. I think he can juggle. I know makes a mean pizza.
Yeah, he's a pizza fiend.
He is. He's got a special pizza oven thing. I don't understand all the foodiness. Anyway, so Ilya, would you like to take us out of here?
Sure. Don't forget to sign up for Ben's OnlyFans, and then afterwards, no.
What?
I'm trying to come up with what actually we should be asking people to what like? No, subscribe? No, do we care about those
like and like, subscribe?
You know what we do want? We do want people leave a one sentence review. If you could leave a one sentence review on Spotify or Google Podcasts. Actually, Google Podcasts doesn't exist anymore. Apple Podcasts. Yeah, if you could leave a one sentence review, that would really be awesome. That would like tell other people like, hey, what you think about this show? If you like the show, great. If you don't like the show, you can leave that too. So.
Yeah, we read them all. We take your criticism seriously.
We do. It's like
get rid of Rock, replace Rock with somebody else. I'm like, hey, I'm out of here.
Now everyone knows what your OnlyFans is. It's you reading the really scathing reviews against the show.
And crying. It's me eating ice cream and crying while I read scathing reviews of the podcast.
All right,
shirtlessly.
So I'm going to adopt your tagline on the way out. Thanks for tuning in.
All right. I think I stole that from your wife, actually. Anyway.
Okay, great. Terrific.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.